Good morning. Well, we're opening up the encyclical Laudato Si, and we looked first at the Pope's dramatic and very clear statement of how we are contributing to the mess of our world and to its destruction. And then he asked us to pull back from the more superficial desires for wealth and power and whatever else to our deepest desire, which is surely for wonder and beauty and an awareness of this wonderful gift we are to each other and that the world is to us. And then we're much less likely to rip it off and just use it for a quick momentary financial gain. Then we looked yesterday, because he took us deeper, he pointed out the people who suffer most from the degradation of the world are the poor. But the so-called richer countries owe a debt to the poorer ones, because we are able to live above what we should be because of the resources that have come from these less developed countries, and the world couldn't live our inverted commas standard of living, it just collapse. So we looked at the poor and what we have to learn from them and how much we owe them, each other. And today I want to take you to another area that the Pope obviously insists on, and that is the whole area of justice. Because the poverty thing has been right there from the beginning, from Jesus, the poor man. That should not be news to us. And justice is at the heart of our Judeo-Christian heritage. So we begin now at this one, talking about justice as we see it in the Hebrew Scriptures or in the Old Testament. And then later this morning, I'll have a look at the New Testament with you. So our topic is justice. Number 36 of Laudato Si, the Pope writes, caring for ecosystems demands far-sightedness. Since no one looking for quick or easy profit is truly interested in their preservation, but the cost of the damage caused by such selfish lack of concern is much greater than the economic benefits to be obtained. Where certain species are destroyed or seriously harmed, the values involved are incalculable. We can be silent witnesses to terrible injustices if we think that we can obtain significant benefits by making the rest of humanity, present and future, pay the extremely high costs of environmental deterioration. Justice. What do we mean? It's about judgments. Judgments are just when they're in accordance with the truth, with the way things really are. In the legislative, judicial, and executive arms of government, in communities, in our own personal lives. This is hugely important and concerns every aspect of our lives. Are we in touch with reality? The word for justice in the Greek Bible, both Old and New Testament, is dikaiosune. It comes from the Greek dike. And dike means right order in nature and in society. It can be translated, and often is, righteousness. And I think I've mentioned before, right wiseness is actually what the word's saying. Being wise as to what is right, what is in accordance with order, divinely instigated order. Something's just when it's right, when it's in accordance with divinely established order. And this takes us back to a lot of our preliminary meditations on listening, obedience, prayer, etc. Justice is fundamental to our faith tradition. I'm reading now from Deuteronomy chapter 1. Give the members of your community a fair hearing. Judge rightly between one person and another, whether citizen or resident alien. You mustn't be partial in judging. Hear out the small and the great alike. You shall not be intimidated by anyone, for the judgment is God's. It's uncertain when that was written, but we're talking something like 2,800 years ago. Like, it's not, the tradition's been long. Book of Proverbs, chapter 31. Speak out. Judge righteously, defend the rights of the poor and needy. And Psalm 85, which we started with in this retreat, steadfast love and faithfulness will meet, righteousness and peace will embrace. Faithfulness will spring up from the ground and righteousness look down from the heavens. It's a hopeful statement, and if we're in touch with it, it'll happen. The Hebrew people never forgot what they were. They were slaves in Egypt and they were liberated from slavery. So at the heart of the wonderful religion, Israel, Judah, Judaism, is this absolutely strong sense of not forgetting where we came from and never allowing anyone to be a slave. Exodus chapter 3, verse 7 to 8. Yahweh said, this is the burning bush scene, Yahweh said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I've heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their suffering. I've come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. What must God be saying, thinking, inspiring when he looks at the misery of so many people in our world? Exodus 3:11-12. Moses said to God, but who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? Who am I that I should contribute to the stopping the deterioration of our world? Who are you? Who are we? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, this is the key, I will be with you. Take it personally, I'll be with you. Moses said to God, if I come to the Israelites and I say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, what's his name? What am I going to say to them? And God says to Moses, it's very beautiful. It's really saying, you can't name me, and I'm not going to give you a name because I haven't got a name. I'm beyond all names. And his answer is, I will be who I will be. Sometimes translated, and it's possible from the Hebrew, I am who I am. But that's very Greek, very abstract. This is, the Hebrew is much closer to this. I'll be who I will be. Just I'll be with you. You'll find me as you go. I'll be there. But you're not going to name me or control me or have a theology about me that locks me in or a book that contains me. I'll be who I will be. You just do what I'm asking you to do. God also said to Moses, thus you shall say to the Israelites, Yahweh. Yahweh is a word totally on its own. It comes from the verb to be, but it's not, doesn't appear anywhere else. And it picks up that thing, I will be who I will be. Has sent me to you. So it's not a name, but it's a mysterious word that holds that promise and that being with. I'm Yahweh. I will free you from slavery. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Creation is meant to be a paradise. That's the early story of Genesis. We rather foolishly took it as historical fact, as though one time Adam and Eve were kind of, I don't know, in paradise. Which just is an Iranian word, a Persian word for an orchard. So with fountains and all that. So that's, no, it wasn't that we were that and then we sinned and then we're now we're this. If evolution has anything to say, and I think it has a lot to say, we evolved from fairly primitive forms of life. The wonder of human beings is not that we're violent. That's in our genes and our DNA. From where we've come from. Lions and every animal in this world is out to live. So the wonder of humanity, I think, is that we can actually love and we can be kind and we can love our enemies even. So human beings were created in God's image for the garden of Yahweh, Eden. God said, here's Genesis, let's make human beings in our own image and likeness. There's a lot I could meditate on that for half an hour with you, but I won't, because it's terribly rich. He goes on, let them rule over creation. Yes, that's what it says. But the word rule over is also used in the literature for a king. And it's a shepherd king. Rule over doesn't mean dominate. It means shepherd. Nurture, carry on what God is doing, which is, in their view, bringing order out of chaos. So our very being here and our intelligence is feeding, urging us to do God's work, which is to bring order out of chaos. Not just leave it as it is, as though it's perfect. It's not. It needs perfecting, and we've got a role there because we're made in the image of God. Yahweh God formed human beings from the dust of the ground. Not from clay, which is kind of permanent and can be stuck on a shelf and last forever nearly. No, this is dust. Very fragile. It's obviously a symbolic image. But he breathed into this dust his own breath. And Yahweh God planted a garden in Eden, and there he put the human beings he'd made. That's the ideal. That's what it should be like. That's what God intended. Why is it the way it is? It is the way it is because we're not listening, we're not nurturing, we're not only, but we're harming nature. We're not acting as those in the image of God. God saw everything that he'd made, and indeed it was very good. So, from God's point of view, the cosmos, the world, our planet, should be a paradise. Why isn't it? because you and I and us, we keep choosing slavery. We've got the word sin for that. And sin, leave guilt out for a minute. Sin, the word sin doesn't imply guilt. We may be guilty. It simply means missing the mark, acting in a way that isn't in the image of God. And there's no doubt we act like that. Sometimes we're guilty for it because we could do it and we don't. Other times we're not, we don't know any better, and people behave the way their parents behave and it's fine. I mean, they don't know any better. So we're a mixture of what we call original sin, meaning the sin that we inherit, the kind of dysfunctional behaviour that we pick up from our genes, etc., and our environment. But then there is this personal thing too, where we could love, but we choose not to. We could heal, but we destroy. We could stop and contemplate, but we rush in for an immediate so-called benefit. All of that may need some word, and the word we've traditionally called it is sin. Not always guilty for it, but we miss the mark a lot. Psalm 143, no one living is righteous before you, God. In other words, we're all aware, all of us, of this propensity to miss the mark, to want to love but we end up hurting, and we want to do something good but we end up mucking it up. No one's perfect. Job 25, how can a human being be righteous before God? How can one born of woman be pure? If even the moon is not bright and the stars are not pure in God's sight, how much less we human beings? It's not a despairing statement, it's just an honest looking in the mirror. But Israel, real, ordinary people who miss the mark a lot, but hit it a lot too, was chosen for a mission to live justly and to take this justice to the nations. And the second bit is the bit that not only Jews at the time of Jesus, but all religious institutions can so easily forget. And this is why Paul was so excited when he was enlightened, he saw that actually this beautiful thing that he loved, namely Judaism, was not going to be found by persecuting people who weren't Jews or were betraying Judaism. It was going to be found by taking justice to the world. And that's what we should have always doing, he's saying in all his letters. We're the children of Abraham, who's the father of many nations, not just us. And the temple was a den of thieves because they were robbing God. We can do that too. We've got God. Christians have got God. Once you say it, it's so stupid, you couldn't say it again, but we can act like that. A conviction that God's commitment is to the whole human race and that God is just, righteous, and so God will always be faithful to this commitment. Genesis 17, this is my commitment to you, Abraham. You'll be the ancestor of a multitude of nations. He says to Isaac, I'll be with you. That's always there, the with. I'll be with you and I'll bless you. To Jacob, I'll be with you. Out of their slavery, their cry for help rose up to God. God heard their groaning and he remembered his commitment to Abraham. Moses, I will be with you. These are quotes taken straight out of the scriptures. God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the Israelites, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent you. He says to Joshua, I will be with you. To Gideon, I will be with you. To David, Nathan said to David, do all that you have in mind, God is with you. To David's heir, David said to his son Solomon, this is out of the book of Chronicles, Be strong, of good courage, and act. Don't be afraid or dismayed, for Yahweh God, my God, is with you. He will not fail you or forsake you. And I hope as I'm reading this out to you, the you is you too, of course, and me. This is the God we have, the God who is with us. To Israel, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. And when you walk through fire, you will not be burned, and the flame will not consume you. And the promised Isaiah chapter 7, promised Messiah, I should have said, Isaiah 7:14, it's possible. He's talking to Ahaz, the king, and the young woman may well be Ahaz's wife, and the one promised may well be the child, who is actually Hezekiah. The dates fit. So it's a likely understanding. Isaiah is saying to the king, don't get caught up in this Assyrian, anti-Assyrian stuff. The young woman is with child and will bear a son, and you'll name him Emmanuel. El is God, of course, with you. Emmanuel. So burned into the psyche of the ancient people of Israel was their sense of identity as a people who were once slaves residing in Egypt. Their God looked on them with compassion and led them out from slavery to freedom and to their own land. Among their core moral principles, therefore, was that they should not oppress a foreigner residing among them, nor neglect the poor. As part of the covenant code at the heart of the constitution of ancient Israel, we read, and this is Exodus chapter 22, you shall not wrong or oppress a resident alien. For you were aliens in the land of Egypt. You shall not abuse any widow or orphan. If you do abuse them, when they cry out to me, I'll surely heed their cry. Obviously, not everyone was faithful to this imperative, especially among those who wielded political and economic power. Again and again, the prophets spoke out against this failure, this sin, this missing the mark, especially when it was supported by legislation and administration that made it hard, if not impossible, for the poor to find redress, because the powerful were creating the laws, and then in God's name, of course. Listen to Amos, the earliest prophet we've got, whose writings are in a scroll named after him. Thus says the Lord, I will revoke my punishment on Israel. I will not revoke my punishment on Israel, because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. There's a lot behind that. The sandals were bought to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. So that's very lovely. They're doing a wonderful thing. They're on a journey, a pilgrimage, a spiritual journey, and the very sandals they're wearing have been ripped off the poor. We may not do that, but we do the equivalent. The needy, they sell the needy for a pair of sandals. They trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of their way. A religious cult, too, is phony when it disregards justice and has no regard for the poor. Here's Amos again, chapter 5. exaggerated language, but it's making his clung point. This is God speaking, as Amos says it, and as people heard it. I despise your festivals. I don't take any delight in your solemn assemblies. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I won't listen to the melody of your harps. Let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. It's confronting, but it's meant to confront us. Isaiah is just as vehement in denouncing the lack of compassion and the failure of justice. Isaiah chapter 5 reads, "Oh, you who join house to house, who add field to field, until there's no room for anyone but you, and you're left to live alone in the midst of the land." Psychologically powerful stuff. You're living in a lush house with broken bottles on the walls and a guard at the gate, and you can't walk the streets in safety, and you call that wealth. You're living alone in the midst of the land. There's no room for anyone but you. That's what's happening in the time of Jesus, by the way. Central people buying up the farms of Galilee. Isaiah 10, "You who make iniquitous decrees, who write oppressive statutes, in turn to turn aside the needy from justice, and to rob the poor of my people of their right, that widows may be your spoil, and that you may make the orphans your prey." What God wants of his people, Isaiah tells us in chapter 58, is to break unjust fetters, to undo the thongs of the yoke. Someone else has done them up. You undo them. To let the oppressed go free and break every yoke. When I was a lot younger and more brash, I suppose, I don't know if I was more brash, but anyhow, I used to dream of a bishop being appointed in our church. You know how they take all these lovely phrases for their escutcheon or whatever you call it. And they're good, and I'm not saying anything about them. But I was waiting for a bishop to have break every yoke. He wouldn't last long, he'd get crucified by it. Everybody, but I thought, what a great saying that would be. Maybe the next pope might take it. The present one's doing it, and it might give courage to the next one to name it. Break every yoke. Propaganda with no concern for truth was then, as it still is, an instrument used by those with the power to further their own agenda and hide the lack of justice in their governing of the people. Isaiah denounced leaders who, quoting from 59, this is post-exilic, these are the disciples, he denounces leaders who conceive lying words, utter them in a sincere way. Justice is pushed aside, honesty is made to stand at a distance, for truth stumbles in the public square, and honesty cannot find a place. Pretty powerful text. Thank God there are good politicians and good legislators and good government public servants, and thank the place is as good as it is because of so much goodness at all those levels. So I've got to thank God for all that. But it's got to be like the spirit of a school if you've been a teacher. It might take years to build up a beautiful spirit in the school. It can be destroyed pretty quickly. Seems easier to pull down than to build. So we've got to just nurture this, all the good people that have given us the country we've got. We've got to watch lies in the public, lies in the build up to an election. Very disappointing. In the period just before the Babylonian destruction of Judah, Jeremiah criticized the king Jehoiakim for not following the example of his father, Josiah, one of the best of their kings. And this is what he's saying to the current prime minister, king at the time, the leader, and he's reminding them of what his father did. And he's saying, look, woe to him who builds his house by injustice, who makes his neighbours work for nothing and doesn't give them their wages, who says, I'll build myself a spacious house with large upper rooms, and who cuts out windows for it, panels it with cedar, paints it with vermilion. That's what that king was doing. Are you a king because you compete in cedar? He says. Didn't your father eat and drink and act with justice and righteousness? Then it was well with him. He judged the cause of the poor and the needy. Then it was well. Is not this to know me? It's a butte sentence. To know Yahweh is to behave the way Josiah was. Not the way you're behaving, he says to the current king. Your eyes and heart are only on dishonest gain, for shedding innocent blood and practicing oppression and violence. God is just, meaning God is faithful to who God is. God is truthful. We may fail to live justly according to the divine order, but God is always there, acting, inspiring, healing, forgiving, encouraging goodness. Laudato Si, number 245, Pope Francis writes, God, who calls us to generous commitment and to give him our all, offers us the light and the strength needed to continue on our way. In the heart of this world, the Lord of life, who loves us so much, is always present. He does not abandon us. He doesn't leave us alone. For he has united himself definitively to our world, and his love constantly impels us to find new ways forward. And in number 76, Pope writes, in the Judeo-Christian tradition, the word creation, this is a beautiful point, the word creation has a broader meaning than nature, for it has to do with God's loving plan in which every creature has its own value and significance. Nature is usually seen as a system which can be studied, understood, and controlled. Whereas creation can only be understood as a gift from the outstretched hand of the Father of all, and as a reality illuminated by the love which calls us together into universal communion. It's one of the most beautiful paragraphs, I think, in the encyclical, number 76. Nature can be a bit abstract or a bit monodimensional or a bit creation keeps reminding us that God's a part of this, holding everything in existence. So that fills us with hope, surely. Number 77, in Pope goes on, by the word of the Lord the heavens were made. This tells us that the world came about as the result of a decision, not from chaos or chance, and this exalts it all the more. The creating word expressed a free choice. Creation is the order of love. God's love is the fundamental moving force in all created things. Quotes from the Book of Wisdom. For you love all things that exist and detest none of the things you've made. And he goes on, every creature is thus the object of the Father's tenderness, who gives it its place in the world. Even the fleeting life of the least of beings is the object of God's love. And in its few seconds of existence, God enfolds it with God's affection. Consequently, we can ascend from created things to the greatness of God and God's loving mercy. Amos, I will restore the fortunes of my people Israel. And the Book of Lamentations, the third lament. That's a little bit of an aside. If ever you're feeling absolutely rock bottom, finished, depressed, despairing, please read the third lamentation. Seriously. Because you'll find, as I found, but you'll find that, God, things could be worse. And it goes in and describes how terrible what's going on, and takes you right down to the bottom. And then in verse 22, it turns. And it reads, the favours of Yahweh are not all past. His kindnesses are not exhausted. Every morning they are renewed. Great is God's faithfulness. And that goes on in a lifting, enlightening, positive light. Called to live in God's likeness, all of us called to that, to leave slavery and to journey to freedom, to live a life of justice and to summon all peoples to do the same, to be just as God is. God remains faithful and God's mission remains. Isaiah 42, written in the exile of Babylon. I am Yahweh. That always, when you see Yahweh or the Lord, that takes you always back to the burning bush. Whenever you read the Lord as a description of God, that's from the Greek, or Yahweh, straight from the Hebrew, it's not a name. It's a historical memory. It's locating, this is the God of the burning bush, the God of redemption, the God who freed people from slavery. So I'm Yahweh. Don't forget that. I've called you in righteousness, justice. I've taken you by the hand and I've kept you. I've given you as a covenant to the people, a light to the nations, to open eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon and from the prison those who sit in darkness. And Isaiah 45, I'm Yahweh, a righteous God and a saviour. There is no one besides me. La ilaha illallah. There is no God but God. And then a wonderful statement. They're all fasting. And they're wondering why God doesn't seem to be listening. In other words, they're doing all the religious things that we're expected to do. And then halfway through, these disciples back in the... they're building the second temple after the exile. And everyone's getting very pious and religious and keen and narrow and controlling, and they'd get rid of all their Moabite wives and they're all going to be pure from now on. God, imagine living in a place like that. Anyhow, these people come out and say, look, isn't this the fast that I want? To loose the bonds of injustice, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and, here it is again, to break every yoke. Is it not to share your bread with the hungry and bring the homeless poor into your house? And when you see the naked, to cover them and not hide yourself from your own kin? Can you imagine the little boy, young boy Jesus, reading this from Isaiah and getting inspired? Because this is part of the place he got his inspirations from. And this is the last judgment, we're told. Then your light will break forth like the dawn, and your healing will spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you, and the glory of Yahweh will be your rear guard. So you're protected from front and behind. Then you can call. No good calling now because you're not living properly. Then you can call and Yahweh will answer. You'll cry for help and you'll say, "Here I am. Here I am." In Nauru. Here I am. Yahweh formed me in the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him, and that Israel might be gathered to him. For I'm honored in the sight of Yahweh, and my God has become my strength. And Yahweh says, "It is too little a thing that you should be my servant and raise up tribes of Jacob and restore the survivors of Israel. No, I'll give you," that's us too, "I'll give you as a light to the nations." It's big stuff, it's Catholic in its best sense. All embracing. "I'll give you as a light to the nations, and my salvation will reach to the ends of the earth." This is all encouraging us to ecological conversion, among other things. Isaiah 51. "Look to Abraham your father and to Sarah who bore you. For Yahweh will comfort Zion," it's Jerusalem, "and will make her wilderness like Eden," paradise. "Give heed to me, my nation, for a teaching will go out from me." The teaching is going out from God through you, through us. "The teaching will go out from me, and my justice for a light to the peoples. I'll bring near my deliverance. My salvation has gone out, and I will rule the people." Rule, shepherd. "The coastlands are waiting for me. My salvation will be forever, and my deliverance will never end." After the return from exile, the promise continues. There's a little map of the Yehud, a little tiny what was left of Judah after the Babylonian captivity. They came back to this tiny landlocked little space. The return from exile was the first step in the deliverance that God promised. Judah, however, was still under foreign rule. From Babylon, Persia. Then it'll become Greece, then it'll become Rome, etc. The writers of Second Temple Judaism looked forward eagerly to Yahweh's liberation of Judah, so that Judah would carry out the mission given to Abraham. How could they carry it out now? They've got no power, they've got no port, they've got no trade, and their population is well down on what it was before. So it's just amazing that any of them kept their faith, but they did. Many thought that Yahweh would do this by raising up a second Moses, a Messiah. And this is where the Messiah idea begins, really. There's no king, So they then dream of a king one day that God will send, an anointed one. Zechariah, a prophet, inverted commas anyhow, living at this time, sing and rejoice, O daughter Zion, for I will come and dwell in your midst, says Yahweh. Many nations will join themselves to Yahweh on that day. This is a dream, a hope. They will be my people, and I'll dwell in your midst, and you'll know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me to you. Again, Zechariah 8. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, peoples shall yet come, the inhabitants of many cities, and inhabitants of one city will go to another, saying, come, let's go to entreat the favour of Yahweh, and to seek Yahweh of hosts. I'm going. And many peoples, you can imagine Paul reading this with great excitement, and many peoples and strong nations will come to seek Yahweh of hosts in Jerusalem. It's okay to think of Constantine and the rest of that as well. They're all involved here. And to entreat the favour of Yahweh. Thus says Yahweh of hosts, in those days, 10 men from nations of every language shall take hold of a Jew, grasping his garment and saying, let's go with you. We've heard that God is with you. And that's what Christianity is. It's Judaism taken to the world. Should be that, is that. How much we're involved in that is up to us, but that's what Christianity is. This beautiful, there's other religions in other parts of the world, of course, with wonderful values. We're not comparing anything, we're just saying this was the history of it. So it's Judaism which opens up to the promise given to Abraham centuries before, and the dream is taken, and what a dream it was, and what an extraordinary early centuries of Christianity. Spread like wildfire, not with military power like another religion spread, but with love. How these Christians love one another, an attraction of love. Book of Tobit, which is a 3rd century romance, chapter 14, has this. God will again have mercy on his scattered people and will bring them back into the land of Israel, and they will rebuild the temple of God, but not like the first one, until the period when the times of fulfillment shall come. I was in Jerusalem years ago and talking to a rabbi in the temple area, and I was just curious. I said, how do you feel about the temple area covered by a mosque? I don't know enough to say he was speaking for everyone, but this is what he said. He said, oh, that's fine. He said, we're happy to see it preserved as a sacred place. And we can't build the temple. The Messiah has to do that. So he's looking forward to the Messiah still coming and rebuilding the temple. That was what he was wanting. God will again have mercy on his scattered people and will bring them back into the land of Israel. And they'll rebuild the temple of God, but not like the first one, until the period when the times of fulfillment will come, the messianic times. After this, they all will return from their exile and rebuild Jerusalem in splendor. And in it, the temple of God will be rebuilt, just as the prophets of Israel have said concerning it. Then the nations in the whole world will all be converted and worship God in truth. They will all abandon their idols, which deceitfully have led them into their error, and in righteousness they will praise the eternal God. So we've got to think of our idols, our culture's idols. All the Israelites who are saved in those days, it's a dream, it's the author's dream, All the Israelites who are saved in those days and are truly mindful of God will be gathered together. They'll go to Jerusalem and live in safety forever in the land of Abraham, and it will be given over to them. Those who sincerely love God will rejoice, but those who commit sin and injustice will vanish from the earth. It's a romance, but somebody in that third century Judah, under the, in this case, the Greek rule, was dreaming of the promises somehow finding fulfillment. And I conclude, all of this leads, and it'll take us at 11 o'clock, to Jesus. Matthew loves to make as many connections as he can with the ancient texts, because in Matthew's time, a lot of Jews, the majority of Jews, were not taking that step. Many were, of course, thousands were, but many weren't, and families were being divided. Christians were even being excluded now from the synagogues because they had to pray a prayer that they couldn't pray, and that sorted them out. They were trying to preserve their faith. The Roman business had shocked everyone and destroyed the place, and Christianity had bled Judaism. So he links back the birth of Jesus, this is Matthew chapter 1, to this text we've already read from Isaiah. They'll name him Emmanuel. God is with us in him, in Jesus. And as Jesus says, or the chorus, it's not clear who's saying it, in John chapter 8, verse 32, you'll know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And if the Son sets you free, wow, then you are truly free. John 8:36. I'll conclude now.